"I suppose," said Taggart, in the cautious tone of an indirect question, "that I should feel flattered you chose to come to this party."
"Oh, but I had to come. I thought you were expecting me."
"Why, no, I wasn't. That is, I mean..."
"You should have expected me, James. This is the great formal nose-counting event, where the victims come in order to show how safe it is to destroy them, and the destroyers form pacts of eternal friendship which last for 3 months. I don't know exactly which group I belong to, but I had to come and be counted, didn't I?"
"What in hell do you think you're saying?"
Taggart cried furiously, seeing the tension on the faces around them. "Be careful, James. If you try to pretend that you don't understand me, I'm going to make it much clearer.
If you think it's proper to utter such..."
"I think it's funny. There was a time when men were afraid that somebody would reveal some secret of theirs that was unknown to their fellows. Nowadays they're afraid that somebody will name what everybody knows. Have you practical people ever thought that that's all it would take to blast your whole big complex structure, with all your laws and guns? Just somebody naming the exact nature of what you're doing?
If you think it's proper to come to a celebration such as a wedding in order to insult the host,
why, James, I came here to thank you."
"To thank me?"
"Of course. You've done me a great favor, you and your boys in Washington, and the boys in Santiago. Only I wonder why none of you took the trouble to inform me about it. Those directives that somebody issued here a few months ago are choking off the entire copper industry of this country, and the result is that this country suddenly has to import much larger amounts of copper. And where in the world is there any copper left? Unless it's Dunconia copper. So you see, I have good reason to be grateful."
"I assure you I had nothing to do with it," Taggart said hastily. "And besides, the vital economic policies of this country are not determined by any considerations such as you're intimating. Or..."
"I know how they're determined, James. I know that the deal started with the boys in Santiago, because they've been on the Dunconia payroll for centuries. Well, no, payroll is an honorable word. It would be more exact to say that Dunconia copper has been paying them protection money for centuries. Isn't that what your gangsters call it? Our boys in Santiago call it taxes. They've been getting their cut on every ton of Dunconia copper sold, so they have a vested interest to see me sell as many tons as possible. But with the world turning into people's states, this is the only country left where men are not yet reduced to digging for roots in forests for their sustenance. So this is the only market left on earth. The boys in Santiago wanted to corner this market. I don't know what they offered to the boys in Washington, or who traded what and to whom. But I know that you came in on it somewhere, because you do hold a sizable chunk of Dunconia copper stock. And it surely didn't displease you, that morning 4 months ago, the day after the directives were issued, to see the kind of soaring leap that Dunconia copper performed on the stock exchange. Why, it practically leaped off the ticker tape and into your face.
Who gave you any grounds to invent an outrageous story of this kind?
Nobody. I knew nothing about it. I just saw the leap on the ticker tape that morning. That told the whole story, didn't it? Besides, the boys in Santiago slapped a new tax on copper the following week, and they told me that I shouldn't mind, not with the sudden rise of my stock. They were working for my best interests, they said. They said, why should I care? Taking the two events together, I was richer than I had been before. True enough, I was.
Why do you wish to tell me this? Why don't you wish to take any credit for it, James?
That's out of character, and out of the policy at which you're such an expert. In an age when men exist, not by right, but by favor, one does not reject a grateful person. One tries to trap into gratitude as many people as possible. Don't you want to have me as one of your men under obligation?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Think what a favor I received without any effort on my part. I wasn't consulted, I wasn't informed, I wasn't thought about. Everything was arranged without me, and all I have to do now is produce the copper. That was a great favor, James, and you may be sure that I will repay it. Francisco turned abruptly, not waiting for an answer, and started away. Taggart did not follow. He stood, feeling that anything was preferable to one more minute of their conversation. Francisco stopped when he came to Dagny. He looked at her for a silent instant without greeting, his smile acknowledging that she had been the first person he saw, and the first one to see him at his entrance into the ballroom. Against every doubt and warning in her mind, she felt nothing but a joyous confidence. Inexplicably, she felt as if his figure in that crowd was a point of indestructible security. But in the moment when the beginning of a smile told him how glad she was to see him, he asked, "Don't you want to tell me what a brilliant achievement the John Galt line turned out to be?" She felt her lips trembling and tightening at once as she answered, "I'm sorry if I show that I'm still open to be hurt. It shouldn't shock me that you've come to the stage where you despise achievement." "Yes, don't I? I despise that line so much that I didn't want to see it reach the kind of end it has reached." He saw her look of sudden attentiveness, the look of thought rushing into a breach torn open upon a new direction. He watched her for a moment, as if he knew every step she would find along that road, then chuckled and said, "Don't you want me to ask now, who is John Galt?" "Why should I want to, and why now? Don't you remember that you dared him to come and claim your line?" "Well, he has." He walked on, not waiting to see the look in her eyes, a look that held anger, bewilderment, and the first faint gleam of a question mark. It was the muscles of his own face that made Reardon realize the nature of his reaction to Francisco's arrival. He noticed suddenly that he was smiling, and that his face had been relaxed into the dim well-being of a smile for some minutes past, as he watched Francisco d'Anconia in the crowd. He acknowledged to himself for the first time all the half-grasped, half-rejected moments when he had thought of Francisco d'Anconia, and thrust the thought aside before it became the knowledge of how much he wanted to see him again. In moments of sudden exhaustion, at his desk, with the fires of the furnaces going down in the twilight, in the darkness of the lonely walk through the empty countryside to his house, in the silence of sleepless nights, he had found himself thinking of the only man who had once seemed to be his spokesman. He had pushed the memory aside, telling himself, "But that one is worse than all the others," while feeling certain that this was not true, yet being unable to name the reason of his certainty. He had caught himself glancing through the newspapers to see whether Francisco d'Anconia had returned to New York, and he had thrown the newspapers aside, asking himself angrily, "What if he did return? Would you go chasing him through nightclubs and cocktail parties? What is it that you want from him?" This was what he had wanted, he thought, when he caught himself smiling at the sight of Francisco in the crowd. This strange feeling of expectation that held curiosity, amusement, and hope. Francisco did not seem to have noticed him. Reardon waited, fighting a desire to approach. Not after the kind of conversation we had, he thought. What for? What would I say to him? And then, with the same smiling, light-hearted feeling, the feeling of being certain that it was right, he found himself walking across the ballroom toward the group that surrounded Francisco d'Anconia. He wondered, looking at them, why these people were drawn to Francisco. Why they chose to hold him imprisoned in a clinging circle, when their resentment of him was obvious under their smiles. Their faces had the hint of a look peculiar not to fear, but to cowardice, a look of guilty anger. Francisco stood cornered against the side edge of a marble stairway, half leaning, half sitting on the steps. The informality of his posture, combined with the strict formality of his clothes, gave him an air of superlative elegance. His was the only face that had the carefree look and the brilliant smile proper to the enjoyment of a party. But his eyes seemed intentionally expressionless, holding no trace of gaiety, showing like a warning signal nothing but the activity of a heightened perceptiveness. Standing unnoticed on the edge of the group, Reardon heard a woman who had large diamond earrings and a flabby, nervous face ask tensely, "Signor d'Anconia, what do you think is going to happen to the world?" "Just exactly what it deserves. Oh, how cruel! Don't you believe in the operation of the moral law, madame?" Francisco asked gravely. "I do." Reardon heard Bertram Scudder outside the group say to a girl who had made some sound of indignation, "Don't let him disturb you. You know, money is the root of all evil, and he's the typical product of money." Reardon did not think that Francisco could have heard it, but he saw Francisco turning to them with a gravely courteous smile. "So you think that money is the root of all evil," said Francisco d'Anconia. "Have you ever asked what is the root of money? Money is a tool of exchange, which can't exist unless there are goods produced and men able to produce them. Money is the material shape of the principle that men who wish to deal with one another must deal by trade and give value for value. Money is not the tool of the moochers who claim your product by tears, or of the looters who take it from you by force. Money is made possible only by the men who produce. Is this what you consider evil? When you accept money in payment for your effort, you do so only on the conviction that you will exchange it for the product of the effort of others. It is not the moochers or the looters who give value to money. Not an ocean of tears, nor all the guns in the world, can transform those pieces of paper in your wallet into the bread you will need to survive tomorrow. Those pieces of paper, which should have been gold, are a token of honor. Your claim upon the energy of the men who produce. Your wallet is your statement of hope that somewhere in the world around you there are men who will not default on that moral principle which is the root of money. Is this what you consider evil? Have you ever looked for the root of production? Take a look at an electric generator and dare tell yourself that it was created by the muscular effort of unthinking brutes. Try to grow a seed of wheat without the knowledge left you by men who had to discover it for the first time. Try to obtain your food by means of nothing but physical motions, and you'll learn that man's mind is the root of all the goods produced and of all the wealth that has ever existed on earth. But you say that money is made by the strong at the expense of the weak. What strength do you mean? It is not the strength of guns or muscles. Wealth is the product of man's capacity to think. Then is money made by the man who invents a motor at the expense of those who did not invent it? Is money made by the intelligent at the expense of the fools? By the able at the expense of the incompetent? By the ambitious at the expense of the lazy? Money is made before it can be looted or mooched. Made by the effort of every honest man, each to the extent of his ability. An honest man is one who knows that he can't consume more than he has produced. To trade by means of money is the code of the men of goodwill. Money rests on the axiom that every man is the owner of his mind and his effort. Money allows no power to prescribe the value of your effort, except the voluntary choice of the man who is willing to trade you his effort in return. Money permits you to obtain for your goods and your labor that which they are worth to the men who buy them, but no more. Money permits no deals, except those to mutual benefit by the unforced judgment of the traders. Money demands of you the recognition that men must work for their own benefit, not for their own injury, for their gain, not their loss. The recognition that they are not beasts of burden born to carry the weight of your misery, that you must offer them values, not wounds. That the common bond among men is not the exchange of suffering, but the exchange of goods. Money demands that you sell not your weakness to men's stupidity, but your talent to their reason. It demands that you buy not the shoddiest they offer, but the best that your money can find. And when men live by trade, with reason, not force, as their final arbiter, it is the best product that wins, the best performance, the man of best judgment and highest ability. And the degree of a man's productiveness is the degree of his reward. This is the code of existence, whose tool and symbol is money. Is this what you consider evil? But money is only a tool. It will take you wherever you wish, but it will not replace you as the driver. It will give you the means for the satisfaction of your desires, but it will not provide you with desires. Money is the scourge of the men who attempt to reverse the law of causality, the men who seek to replace the mind by seizing the products of the mind. Money will not purchase happiness for the man who has no concept of what he wants. Money will not give him a code of values if he's evaded the knowledge of what to value, and it will not provide him with a purpose if he's evaded the choice of what to seek. Money will not buy intelligence for the fool, or admiration for the coward, or respect for the incompetent. The man who attempts to purchase the brains of his superiors to serve him, with his money replacing his judgment, ends up by becoming the victim of his inferiors. The men of intelligence desert him, but the cheats and the frauds come flocking to him, drawn by a law which he has not discovered, that no man may be smaller than his money. Is this the reason why you call it evil? Only the man who does not need it is fit to inherit wealth. The man who would make his own fortune no matter where he started. If an heir is equal to his money, it serves him. If not, it destroys him. But you look on and you cry that money corrupted him, did it? Or did he corrupt his money? Do not envy a worthless heir. His wealth is not yours, and you would have done no better with it. Do not think that it should have been distributed among you. Loading the world with 50 parasites instead of one would not bring back the dead virtue which was the fortune. Money is a living power that dies without its root. Money will not serve the mind that cannot match it. Is this the reason why you call it evil? Money is your means of survival. The verdict you pronounce upon the source of your livelihood is the verdict you pronounce upon your life. If the source is corrupt, you have damned your own existence. Did you get your money by fraud, by pandering to men's vices or men's stupidity, by catering to fools in the hope of getting more than your ability deserves, by lowering your standards, by doing work you despise for purchasers you scorn? If so, then your money will not give you a moment's or a penny's worth of joy. Then all the things you buy will become not a tribute to you, but a reproach, not an achievement, but a reminder of shame. Then you'll scream that money is evil, evil because it would not pinch hit for your self-respect, evil because it would not let you enjoy your depravity. Is this the root of your hatred of money? Money will always remain an effect, and refuse to replace you as the cause. Money is the product of virtue, but it will not give you virtue, and it will not redeem your vices. Money will not give you the unearned, neither in matter nor in spirit. Is this the root of your hatred of money? Or did you say it's the love of money that's the root of all evil? To love a thing is to know and love its nature. To love money is to know and love the fact that money is the creation of the best power within you, and your passkey to trade your effort for the effort of the best among men. It's the person who would sell his soul for a nickel, who is loudest in proclaiming his hatred of money. And he has good reason to hate it. The lovers of money are willing to work for it. They know they are able to deserve it. Let me give you a tip on a clue to men's characters. The man who damns money has obtained it dishonorably. The man who respects it has earned it. Run for your life from any man who tells you that money is evil. That sentence is the leper's bell of an approaching looter. So long as men live together on earth and need means to deal with one another, their only substitute, if they abandon money, is the muzzle of a gun. But money demands of you the highest virtues, if you wish to make it or to keep it. Men who have no courage, pride, or self-esteem, men who have no moral sense of their right to their money, and who are not willing to defend it as they defend their life, who apologize for being rich, will not remain rich for long. They are the natural bait for the swarms of looters that stay under rocks for centuries but come crawling out at the first smell of a man who begs to be forgiven for the guilt of owning wealth. They will hasten to relieve him of the guilt, and of his life, as he deserves. Then you will see the rise of the men of the double standard, the men who live by force, yet count on those who live by trade to create the value of their looted money, the men who are the hitchhikers of virtue. In a moral society, these are the criminals, and the statutes are written to protect you against them. But when a society establishes criminals by right and looters by law, men who use force to seize the wealth of disarmed victims, then money becomes its creator's avenger. Such looters believe it safe to rob defenseless men once they've passed a law to disarm them. But their loot becomes the magnet for other looters, who get it from them as they got it. Then the race goes not to the ablest at production, but to those most ruthless at brutality. When force is the standard, the murderer wins over the pickpocket. And then that society vanishes in a spread of ruins and slaughter. Do you wish to know whether that day is coming? Watch money. Money is the barometer of a society's virtue. When you see that trading is done not by consent, but by compulsion, when you see that in order to produce, you need to obtain permission from men who produce nothing, when you see that money is flowing to those who deal not in goods, but in favors, when you see that men get richer by graft and by pull than by work, and your laws don't protect you against them, but protect them against you, when you see corruption being rewarded and honesty becoming a self-sacrifice, you may know that your society is doomed. Money is so noble a medium that it does not compete with guns, and it does not make terms with brutality. It will not permit a country to survive as half property, half loot. Whenever destroyers appear among men, they start by destroying money, for money is men's protection and the base of a moral existence. Destroyers seize gold and leave to its owners a counterfeit pile of paper. This kills all objective standards and delivers men into the arbitrary power of an arbitrary setter of values. Gold was an objective value, an equivalent of wealth produced. Paper is a mortgage on wealth that does not exist, backed by a gun aimed at those who are expected to produce it. Paper is a check drawn by legal looters upon an account which is not theirs, upon the virtue of the victims. Watch for the day when it bounces, marked account overdrawn. When you have made evil the means of survival, do not expect men to remain good. Do not expect them to stay moral and lose their lives for the purpose of becoming the fodder of the immoral. Do not expect them to produce when production is punished and looting rewarded. Do not ask who is destroying the world. You are. You stand in the midst of the greatest achievements of the greatest productive civilization, and you wonder why it's crumbling around you, while you're damning its lifeblood, money. You look upon money as the savages did before you, and you wonder why the jungle is creeping back to the edge of your cities. Throughout men's history, money was always seized by looters of one brand or another, whose names changed, but whose method remained the same, to seize wealth by force, and to keep the producers bound, demeaned, defamed, deprived of honor. That phrase about the evil of money, which you mouthed with such righteous recklessness, comes from a time when wealth was produced by the labor of slaves, slaves who repeated the motions once discovered by somebody's mind and left unimproved for centuries. So long as production was ruled by force and wealth was obtained by conquest, there was little to conquer. Yet through all the centuries of stagnation and starvation, men exalted the looters as aristocrats of the sword, as aristocrats of birth, as aristocrats of the bureau, and despised the producers as slaves, as traders, as shopkeepers, as industrialists. To the glory of mankind there was, for the first and only time in history, a country of money, and I have no higher, more reverent tribute to pay to America for this means. A country of reason, justice, freedom, production, achievement. For the first time, man's mind and money were set free, and there were no fortunes by conquest, but only fortunes by work, and instead of swordsmen and slaves, there appeared the real maker of wealth, the greatest worker, the highest type of human being. The self-made man, the American industrialist. If you ask me to name the proudest distinction of Americans, I would choose, because it contains all the others, the fact that they were the people who created the phrase, to make money. No other language or nation had ever used these words before. Men had always thought of wealth as a static quantity, to be seized, begged, inherited, shared, looted, or obtained as a favor. Americans were the first to understand that wealth has to be created. The words to make money hold the essence of human morality. Yet these were the words for which Americans were denounced by the rotted cultures of the looters' continents. Now the looters' credo has brought you to regard your proudest achievements as a hallmark of shame, your prosperity as guilt, your greatest men, the industrialists, as blackguards, and your magnificent factories as the product and property of muscular labor, the labor of whip-driven slaves, like the pyramids of Egypt. The rotter who simpers that he sees no difference between the power of the dollar and the power of the whip ought to learn the difference on his own hide, as I think he will. Until and unless you discover that money is the root of all good, you ask for your own destruction. When money ceases to be the tool by which men deal with one another, then men become the tools of men. Blood, whips, and guns, or dollars. Take your choice, there is no other, and your time is running out. Francisco had not glanced at Reardon once while speaking, but the moment he finished, his eyes went straight to Reardon's face. Reardon stood motionless, seeing nothing but Francisco d'Anconia across the moving figures and angry voices between them. There were people who had listened, but now hurried away, and people who said, "It's horrible. It's not true. How vicious and selfish," saying it loudly and guardedly at once, as if wishing that their neighbors would hear them, but hoping that Francisco would not. "Señor d'Anconia," declared the woman with the earrings, "I don't agree with you. If you can refute a single sentence I uttered, madam, I shall hear it gratefully." "Oh, I can't answer you. I don't have any answers. My mind doesn't work that way. But I don't feel that you're right, so I know that you're wrong.
How do you know it?
I feel it. I don't go by my head, but by my heart. You might be good at logic, but you're heartless.
Madame, when we see men dying of starvation around us, your heart won't be of any earthly use to save them. And I'm heartless enough to say that when you'll scream, "But I didn't know it," you will not be forgiven.
The woman turned away, a shudder running through the flesh of her cheeks and through the angry tremor of her voice.
Well, it's certainly a funny way to talk at a party.
A portly man with evasive eyes said loudly, his tone of forced cheerfulness suggesting that his sole concern in any issue was not to let it become unpleasant.
If this is the way you feel about money, senor, I think I'm darn glad that I've got a goodly piece of Dunconia copper stock.
Francisco said gravely, I suggest that you think twice, sir. Reardon started toward him, and Francisco, who had not seemed to look in his direction, moved to meet him at once, as if the others had never existed.
Hello, said Reardon simply, easily, as to a childhood friend. He was smiling. He saw his own smile reflected in Francisco's face.
Hello. I want to speak to you.
To whom do you think I've been speaking for the last quarter of an hour?
Reardon chuckled, in the manner of acknowledging an opponent's round.
I didn't think you had noticed me.
I noticed when I came in that you were one of the only two persons in this room who were glad to see me.
Aren't you being presumptuous?
No. Grateful.
Who was the other person glad to see you?
Francisco shrugged and said lightly,
A woman.
Reardon noticed that Francisco had led him aside, away from the group, in so skillfully natural a manner that neither he nor the others had known it was being done intentionally.
I didn't expect to find you here, said Francisco.
You shouldn't have come to this party.
Why not?
May I ask what made you come?
My wife was anxious to accept the invitation.
Forgive me if I put it in such form, but it would have been much more proper and less dangerous if she had asked you to take her on a tour of whorehouses.
What danger are you talking about?
Mr. Reardon, you do not know these people's way of doing business, or how they interpret your presence here. In your code, but not in theirs, accepting a man's hospitality is a token of goodwill, a declaration that you and your host stand on terms of a civilized relationship. Don't give them that kind of sanction.
Then why did you come here?
Francisco shrugged gaily. Oh, it doesn't matter what I do. I'm only a party hound.
What are you doing at this party?
Just looking for conquests.
Found any?
His face suddenly earnest. Francisco answered gravely, almost solemnly.
Yes.
What I think is going to be my best and greatest.
Reardon's anger was involuntary, the cry not of reproach, but of despair.
How can you waste yourself that way?
The faint suggestion of a smile, like the rise of a distant light, came into Francisco's eyes as he asked,
Do you care to admit that you care about it?
You're going to hear a few more admissions, if that's what you're after. Before I met you, I used to wonder how you could waste a fortune such as yours. Now it's worse, because I can't despise you as I did, as I'd like to. Yet the question is much more terrible. How can you waste a mind such as yours?
I don't think I'm wasting it right now.
I don't know whether there's ever been anything that meant a damn to you, but I'm going to tell you what I've never said to anyone before, when I met you. Do you remember that you said you wanted to offer me your gratitude?
There was no trace of amusement left in Francisco's eyes. Reardon had never faced so solemn a look of respect.
Yes, Mr. Reardon, he answered quietly. I told you that I didn't need it, and I insulted you for it.
All right, you've won.
That speech you made tonight?
That was what you were offering me, wasn't it?
Yes, Mr. Reardon.
It was more than gratitude. And I needed the gratitude. It was more than admiration, and I needed that, too. It was much more than any word I can find. It will take me days to think of all that it's given me. But one thing I do know. I needed it. I've never made an admission of this kind, because I've never cried for anyone's help. If it amused you to guess that I was glad to see you, you have something real to laugh about now, if you wish.
It might take me a few years, but I will prove to you that these are the things I do not laugh about.
Prove it now, by answering one question. Why don't you practice what you preach?
Are you sure that I don't?
If the things you said are true, if you have the greatness to know it, you should have been the leading industrialist of the world by now. Francisco said gravely, as he had said to the portly man, but with an odd note of gentleness in his voice, I suggest that you think twice, Mr. Reardon.
I've thought about you more than I care to admit. I have found no answer.
Let me give you a hint. If the things I said are true, who is the guiltiest man in this room tonight?
I suppose. James Taggart?
No, Mr. Reardon.